Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Welcome to this session of Sunstone Symposium. The speaker today is, you probably all know, Jan Shipps, who describes herself as coming from the University of Uipui, or UIPUI, the University of Indiana and Purdue University at Indianapolis. She's been described by members of the Mormon History Association as the den mother of Mormon history. She was the president of the Mormon History Association. By anti-Mormons, she's been called the Mormon mascot for her interest in Mormon studies. I was interested, one thing on her vita was that she was a project coordinator for a time at the Kinsey Institute for Sex Research, which is an... but she's now a professor of history at, as I mentioned, and her book that everyone is familiar with, of course, is Mormonism, Story of a New Religious Tradition. And she's currently working on two other studies, one on Mormonism in the mid-20th century and one on public opinion about the Mormons between 1860 and 1960. Without any other introduction, we'll have her come to present her paper, and then otherwise, Dr. Lynn England, a professor of sociology at Brigham Young University, will give the response without any further introduction there either.
Okay, I'm very... Did I get it? So, can you hear me in the back? Is this thing really working? Doesn't sound like it's working, but that's okay. I am really delighted to be here. And if I put things up this way and put them back down and so forth, I left this morning and left my briefcase with my glasses in it in the car when my husband left me off at the airport at 6 o'clock. And we had already driven an hour to get there, so you can imagine I wasn't exactly awake. So, okay, here we go. One of the byproducts of the bombings that occurred in Salt Lake City in the fall of 1985 was a media blitz of an intensity unprecedented since the days of the hearings conducted by the U.S. Senate in the matter of the right of Apostle Reed Smoot to hold the seat to which he had been duly elected. Reviewing the media coverage of the murders and subsequent revelations of suspected forgery of documents that allegedly shed light on controversial aspects of Mormon history, Elder Dallin Oaks found so much evidence of prejudicial reporting that he recently indicted the media for Mormon bashing. While many of the accounts of that big story reflect a certain anti-Mormon bias, it is nevertheless unlikely that Mormon bashing was actually the intent of most of the reporters assigned to the Hoffman story. The fact is that this was a very big story. Rather than its having been covered, as are many, or I might even say most news stories from Salt Lake, by religion writers whose business it is to understand Mormonism, the story was covered for the most part by professionals skilled in crime reporting. More often than not, these were persons who knew practically nothing about the Latter-day Saints. Moreover, with their Protestant and Roman Catholic backgrounds, many of them found Mormonism difficult to understand, since it differs from traditional Christianity in ways that are sometimes so subtle that the divergence turns on variant meanings of identical words or phrases. I can speak with some authority about this matter because my book on Mormonism had been published shortly before the murders happened. There was no connection. And but I turned out to be one of the resource persons interviewed by great numbers of reporters. Not all, but nearly all of them asked me for capsule accounts of LDS history and doctrine. In addition, they wanted clear and unambiguous descriptions of Mormonism's ecclesiastical structure and an outline of the procedures by which decisions are made in the church. But I soon learned that most of the reporters who called me were working, as they always seem to do, with rapidly approaching deadlines. They had neither the time nor the inclination to appreciate the complicated structure of the Mormon world. Consequently, the inaccuracy and apparent bias of many of the accounts that were featured prominently in the electronic and print media did not so much reflect malevolence on the part of those who wrote the stories as it revealed their inability to adequately comprehend the complexities of Mormonism. Mormonism, a phenomenon that is, at one and the same time, a unique religious system and a distinctive culture. Because the Hoffman story had such a direct bearing on church history, I frequently found myself, in the many telephone conversations I had with reporters, I found myself attempting to try to explain to them what canonization is and how it operates in religion, not just in Mormonism, but in all religions. In this connection, I almost always found it necessary to try to explain what correlation is and how it operates in the LDS Church. If the somewhat garbled account of what I said that appeared in Time magazine is any indication, it's obvious that I did not always get my points across. Even so, if these conversations were not always helpful to the reporters, they were instructive to me because they made it very clear that correlation is extremely easy to misunderstand. This is particularly true in the case of non-Mormons whose comprehension of Mormonism is either incomplete or imprecise. To such persons, correlation is typically perceived as a form of censorship, an engine of intellectual oversight necessary to an authoritarian ecclesiastical system. A more pejorative perception is present among inherently suspicious anti-Mormons. They routinely regard correlation as a critical part of the great conspiracy by which church authorities maintain dominion over all aspects of the lives of the Latter-day Saints. Few saints would go so far in characterizing correlation as an effective control mechanism whose primary purpose is mind control. Still, one finds Mormons all across the church who complain, often vociferously and not always privately, about the standardization of everything from lesson plans to ward chapels. And LDS intellectuals regularly lament the need for canonization and conformity in matters of history and doctrine. Yet saints ordinarily see correlation in the context of the need for order in a church which is expanding numerically and geographically. Even as they protest its effect, they recognize its utility. And some Latter-day Saints, particularly those in positions of authority, do not merely regard correlation and its accompaniment, priesthood reorganization, as necessary evils. Elder Marion G. Romney, who feared that, quote, if harmony in procedure could not be achieved, quote, we'd soon have apostate practices all over the church, Elder Romney saw correlation as a blessing. Moreover, church presidents and members of the Quorum of the Twelve seem in recent years to have come to understand correlation as nothing less than the working out of a divine plan whose institution is necessary preparation for the coming of the millennium. In the preparation for this book on Mormonism in the mid-20th century, I have been working my way through the oral histories of many general authorities. In doing so, I have learned that many other LDS leaders likewise believe that correlation and priesthood reorganization are divinely inspired. Exactly what is it that could engender such a wide range of responses? That is not an easy question to answer. It's not easy to explain to people who do not persistently experience the impact of correlation. Part of the problem is the fact that correlation is extremely difficult to define. Perhaps more visibly than in any other way, correlation is an activity through which materials prepared at the direction of the church for official use by the priesthood or in auxiliaries or for instruction by the church educational system or for publication in LDS, with the LDS church imprimatur, in which these materials are made consistent and brought into line with established doctrine and canonized accounts of the Mormon past. In that sense, correlation implies action. To correlate is a verb form. But correlation is also a noun, for it is a process as well. To put something through correlation is a procedure not unlike subjecting raw material to refinement and polishing. The correlated result, here the word is used as an adjective, is a product that has had impurities and extraneous matter removed to make it attractive, acceptable, harmless. One could think in this connection not only of precious metals subjected to the refiner's fire, but of a cereal such as wheat, which is polished and refined to create white flour from which Wonder Bread is made instead of brown bread, or of rice, which is put through a process so that instead of being whole and brown, it is converted into the Uncle Ben's variety. Furthermore, correlation has a local habitation as well as a name. People can go over to the LDS church office building and go up to correlation and talk to the individuals who work there. While such usage is obviously part of the Mormon vernacular, it complicates the definition problem, as does the existence of an official correlation committee composed of general authorities called and ordained to carry out the business of the church. Actually, however, considering the correlation committee in the abstract, that is, not looking at the persons themselves who serve on this committee, but thinking about the committee in light of the positions its members occupy in the organizational structure, can simplify the task of explaining correlation. Attacking the problem of definition in this manner clarifies the situation because it reveals correlation as something more than a bureaucratic mechanism by disclosing the extent to which correlation and authority, which implies divine sanction in Mormonism, are intertwined. In view of this connection, it follows that correlation must be defined first as a concept, or, if you will, a philosophy, fundamental to modern Mormonism, and after that, as a bureaucratic mechanism. But if it's a concept and a philosophy, how does it fit in? Pragmatically and very obviously, correlation as activity or procedure is designed to prevent overlap and to eliminate the inevitable confusion, certain mission presidents would put it stronger and call it chaos, that issues from the very success Mormonism is experiencing. Therefore, correlation is clearly and directly related to that fundamental LDS principle of order. But I believe there is more to correlation than its being a means of bringing order out of chaos. Finding where correlation fits as a fundamental principle in and of itself is not as simple. The LDS standard works contain many references to order, but references to correlation are, as far as I can determine, missing from their pages. Still, correlation is basic to modern Mormonism. How? Strangely enough, one means of getting a handle on this most Mormon of phenomena is to go to Webster's, that is, a Gentile dictionary. It confines a correlate as one of the two things that are related so directly that they imply or are complementary one to another as husband and wife. That's a direct quote, as husband and wife. The cheap version of Webster's, I thought I was getting a cheap version. I mean, I thought I was getting a bargain. My husband says, just cheap version. The cheap version of Webster's Unabridged says further that correlation is, quote, that which establishes a reciprocal relation to something else, as father to son or mother to daughter. In other words, correlation is connected to who one is, to one's identity. For that reason, it helps relate correlation to another essential element of Mormonism, its identity, its exclusive claim to having access to the plan of salvation. Note, I didn't say a plan, I said the plan. This exclusive claim is, and always has been, pivotal to the Latter-day Saints' understanding of themselves, who they are, and how they relate to other Latter-day Saints and to the rest of the world. Their powerful perception of chosenness stands at the heart of Mormon identity, just as it has always stood at the heart of the identities or who are persons of traditions arising from Hebraic religious belief. This LDS identity is the sine qua non of Mormonism. Without it, Mormons would become indistinguishable from that great generalized body of persons who, by proclaiming the Christ, have an identity as Christians that is not really particularized. As one of that multitudinous body, I can bear witness to the fact that it is a precarious identity indeed, an identity which all too easily shades off into nothingness. Joseph Smith's revelations reflect a clear knowledge of the danger to Christian identity that pluralism posed. When you stand back and take stock, it is possible to see that, if I can use so mundane a phrase, the bottom line of the gospel revealed through the Book of Mormon and the revelations given through the LDS prophets, especially, of course, Joseph Smith, is that the blood of Israel courses through the veins of the saints. They are separate from all other persons. They are chosen. Theirs is the kingdom. They are Mormons. Protecting the Republic is the first responsibility of any government. Unless that fact is kept in mind in the case of the United States, it is hard to comprehend, much less come to terms with, the proportion of our nation's budget that must be expended on defense. In like manner, unless the fact that protecting LDS identity is the primary responsibility of the LDS Church, it is hard to comprehend, and I would expect equally hard to come to terms with, the sometimes seemingly disproportionate control of Mormonism that emanates from 47 East South Temple and 50 East North Temple in Salt Lake City. Because correlation has been the conduit through which control has radiated outward from center to periphery in recent years, this reasonable conception, this rational organizational principle, has become controversial. As indicated, from the center, priesthood correlation is perceived to be not only effective, but, to use the words of Elder Dean Larson's oral history, a product of, quote, divine method and design. This perception has been current among general authorities at least since the administration of President Harold B. Lee, who took the lead in correlation, of course, in the 60s. Before proceeding to a brief overview of correlation from 1907 forward, it would be well to return to this matter of Mormon identity for a moment. How, we may ask, is LDS identity formed in the first place, and how, subsequently, is it passed from one generation to the next? As anyone who has ever served in a ward bishopric can tell you, or, in fact, anyone who has been actively involved in any ward for very long can tell you, LDS identity does not rest entirely on what a person believes. It is quite possible to accept intellectually all the principles of the gospel, to believe that the Book of Mormon is precisely what it claims to be, to accept the claim that the LDS priesthood is the only legitimate priesthood, that only when administered by LDS priesthood holders are sacraments effective, that there are 3 degrees of glory, that women have access to the priesthood only through men, through their husbands, and practically every other point of LDS doctrine, and still not really be a Mormon. There is an experiential dimension to forging a Mormon identity as well. Saints have to live the gospel, not just believe it. Otherwise, their identity as Mormons is so truncated that it can be as easily taken off as it was put on. The discrepancy between the numbers of active saints and total LDS membership, that massive 6 million figure, testifies to this reality. We know that there are lots of lost saints. Although it is necessary, belief is not enough. Then there's the matter of LDS history. As attention to any of the many TV soaps and movies that employ amnesia in their plot lines demonstrates, if you don't know who you were, you really have a hard time finding out who you are. This is as true at the corporate as at the individual level. Nations have a need to know about their past. Religious communities also have a need to know about their past. Unless this need is satisfied, the community is likely to lose its coherence, its corporate identity, paving the way for its members to drift away, identifying with another community, perhaps, or simply becoming secular altogether in the case of religions. As a result, because it is responsible for LDS identity, the church has to function as a teacher, imparting its theology and history to new converts and new generations alike. It also has to serve as pastor and priest, turning the necessary process of surviving in the world into the meaningful process of living the gospel. In Mormonism, authority is vested in the priesthood, an ecclesiastical hierarchy whose task can generally be categorized into teaching, pastoring, and priesting. These correlate roughly, I'm not sure that's maybe a pun, these correlate roughly with proclaiming the gospel, perfecting the saints, and redeeming the dead, but only roughly. Actually, throughout LDS history, authority to accomplish these necessary tasks has been exercised in quite different fashions. To summarize ever so briefly, during the early years, and particularly during the pioneer period, Mormonism was engaged in building the kingdom. Its organizational structure at the general level as well as at the individual unit level was familial, patriarchal. Authority was exercised directly and personally. Everyone in the Pioneer Utah area knew that Brother Brigham was in charge. Bill Hartley tells us in his account of the 1877 priesthood reorganization that uniformity and direct line authority was almost non-existent. Some wards had presidents, not bishops, and many members of the Council of the Twelve also were stake presidents. Authority was administered casually in this situation and very often on an ad hoc basis. But the Mormon movement survived into the 20th century because But the Mormon movement survived in the 19th century because its experiential dimension gave saints a corporate identity as God's own people. The pastoral function could be exercised more easily in a harsher but simpler world, especially as the saints were enjoined together to be in one place, and they had direct experience of knowing God's agent in time, that is, President Young, and after him, other presidents. But at some point, or more precisely, at a series of points between that pioneer beginning and today, Mormonism was transformed. Mormon historians tend to describe this as a period of transition. I don't think that word is strong enough. I believe it was a transformation. But whether transition or transformation, the period between 1890 and 1945 cannot simply be dismissed as a time of getting from there to here. This middle period had an internal unity that has been studied, especially by Tom Alexander, and that can be summarized as follows. Extending from about 1890 through the Second World War, this period was a time in which authority was exercised in a less direct fashion than it was exercised in the pioneer era, and than authority in Mormonism is exercised nowadays. In the pioneer era, it was exercised very directly. That is, a person was told, this is what to do, and is exercised today in direct line authority. But non-Mormons at the end of the century perceived the direct exercise of religious authority, whether Roman Catholic or Mormon, as un-American. Consequently, they forced the creation in Mormonism of a context of authority which bore on the saints not directly so much as indirectly. It bore, through geographical divisions, stakes, wards, branches, and missions, but it also bore indirectly through informal council and through the auxiliaries, the Relief Society, the church, the Sunday School, the Mutual Improvement Association, primary genealogy, etc. And that was not all bad. Saints who had no special affinity for persons in the bishopric could distance themselves from the priesthood authority exercised through the ward, yet not have to move into an inactivity. They could find file leaders, that is, authority figures, whose authority came through the auxiliaries rather than the stakes and wards. Not officially, of course, but psychologically. Then, as opposed to direct line authority, always funneled through the ward, they could, in this middle period, be supported by what might be called a web of authority, a contextual authority. There was authority in several directions, not just one. In the years immediately following the Second World War, a burgeoning LDS bureaucracy complicated this situation. In addition to this web of authority between the ward stake line and the auxiliaries, saints started to experience fragmented authority as a bureaucratic support system developed to make possible the organization of wards and stakes throughout the rest of the nation. The existence, for example, of a central real estate department, a central building department, a church welfare system, in all cases, decisions were subject to approval from Salt Lake, and all sorts of other departments who had to get approval from Salt Lake, caused confusion and delay at the local level. This led some saints to conclude, as Roman Catholics concluded centuries earlier, very often the Mormons think they invented things the Catholics have known for years, that, quote, it is easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. The fragmentation resulting from a church structured in this fashion caused so much concern in church leadership circles that long before explosive church growth made this organizational structure problematic, efforts were made to correlate the work of the various church departments and to correlate the auxiliaries. Actually, the auxiliaries were, they attempted correlation of the auxiliaries first. In 1907, a movement of correlation was introduced, a movement whose purpose was the correlation of the church curriculum to bring order into the way in which the church performed its teaching function, and to correlate weekday and Sunday activities, bringing order to Mormonism's experiential dimension. A general church committee was set up in 1908, not much happened. Not until 1920, when correlation, as it was known then, was combined with the Social Advisory Committee, which represented the general boards of all LDS auxiliaries. The purpose of these early correlation activities was reviewing the relationship between priesthood and auxiliaries with an eye to eliminating gaps and overlaps. They really didn't want young Latter-day Saints to learn the same thing in primary and Sunday school, or the same thing in Sunday school and priesthood and so forth. The committee recommended setting up correlation committees at ward, stake, and general levels, but this recommendation was not implemented until what Merrill R. Petty described as a stick method of reporting became so cumbersome that change was mandatory. What, you are no doubt asking, is a stick method of reporting? Well, this was a system of exercising authority in which local auxiliaries reported to general boards in Salt Lake City. Local building committees reported to the General Building Committee in Salt Lake City. Local real estate committees reported to the Central Real Estate Committees in Salt Lake City, and so on. There was, of course, delay and very often confusion, as the communication in Salt Lake City had to take place before it could travel back to the local area and let things proceed at that level. Naturally, the spread of Mormonism made this kind of reporting system unwieldy and wildly ineffective, creating a terrible need for coordination. More important, the post-World War II explosion in church growth placed strains on the perpetuation of LDS identity that can hardly be imagined. Not only were saints going out from the center throughout this nation, but all across the world, the church's teaching function became enormously complicated by the infusion into the church and culture and Mormon culture of persons from geographical and socioeconomic spectra of incredible diversity. The intellectual and experiential freedom facilitated during Mormonism's earlier years simply could not be tolerated in this new age, lest Latter-day Saints at the periphery forgot or never learned what it meant to be a Mormon. The Social Advisory Committee had recommended setting up correlation committees at ward, stake, and general levels in the 1920s, but this was not immediately implemented. It did not become policy until ward and stake councils were organized in the 1960s. The formation of an all-church coordinating council, a forerunner of correlation as it is known today, took place in 1961. Its task was nothing less than presiding over the church, children, youth, and adults. The 1960s proved to be a turning point, moving Mormonism out of its middle period, literally into this new modern era. In 1963, home teaching committees were set up in each ward, and priesthood executive committees were organized as well. Also, ward councils made up of priesthood executive committees and the heads of all the auxiliaries were formed, and authority was funneled in at the bishop's level. In 1964, further, a major change came in the home teaching program, as the old ward teaching program was redefined and oversight of the saints was made a direct priesthood responsibility. This changed the nature of home teaching from instruction, monthly lessons, to informal interviews that demonstrated patriarchal concern for the spiritual welfare and the level of church activities of families. Home teaching was, before this, the imparting of information. Now it was the gathering of information. But the purpose of gathering information was to tell the people who were being asked about what was going on in their lives that the priesthood really cared. The family home evening program was not new in 1965. President Heber J. Grant had held such gatherings in the 1920s, and others had been held even earlier. But the emphasis placed on the home evening program was new. Integrally related to the provision of a specific time in which family members came together was the great stress placed on priesthood leadership within the family. More and more authority came to rest in the priesthood at the head of the household, and after that, at the head of the ward, and after that, at the head of the stake, and after that, at the head of the region, and so on. The old web of authority, with all its problems and flaws and all its advantages, started to disappear. In 1967, the demise of stick reporting came about, and that same year, the position of regional representative was created, a position which would eventually stretch the length of the authority line between ordinary saints in the pews and the central leadership of the church. It would take an inexhaustible supply of flowcharts, even to sketch out the history of what happened as correlation found its way into the basic fabric of the LDS Church, and to a lesser extent into LDS culture. In retrospect, however, it is possible to summarize the outcome as of integrating correlation both as procedure and principle into Mormonism. First of all, the responsibility of the priesthood was more clearly defined and separated into categories. That is, the priesthood was responsible for missionary work, genealogy, welfare, and home teaching. The breakdown of church programs has become almost entirely chronological, with programs serving children when they're children, youth when they're youth, and adults. They're all clearly separated, each from the other. Far more important, the mission of the church was clarified and organized into the three major categories of proclaiming the gospel, perfecting the saints, and redeeming the dead. Instead of extending this description of the effect of correlation on the life of the LDS Church and its members, I would like to bring this presentation to a close with a few general observations about the pros and cons of this great sea change which correlation has brought to Mormonism. There are two dimensions to the experience of the Mormons, I've said, the ecclesiastical and the everyday, the church and the culture. For most Latter-day Saints, the shift to direct line authority, with the rigidity that shift implies, has rarely impinged on their spiritual and religious lives. Indeed, in many cases, especially at the periphery and in other countries, correlation has made that dimension richer because it has had the effect of protecting the saints' identity in these latter days. Moreover, from the practical standpoint, correlation has brought a rough order to the everyday experience of being a Mormon. Reporting lines are set, and doctrinal and theological questions are answered with authority and without ambiguity. But there are other effects of correlation, and one is the effect correlation has on the expansion of the church bureaucracy. To those Mormons who make up the church bureaucracy, and the number has mushroomed since World War II, this change has an intensity that is hard to appreciate from the outside. For saints in the bureaucracy, ecclesiastical authority is not only exercised over their spiritual lives, but over their pocketbooks. They have to depend on the church not only in the spiritual, but in the economic realm. As a result, the paid LDS bureaucracy has, as Mormonism has been reorganized and correlated, become more timid and less autonomous. A syndrome very familiar to the corporate business world, much more familiar to that world than to earlier Mormonism, but very familiar to the Roman Catholics, seems to be developing today. It could be called the PYR, some people say PYA syndrome, protect your rear. Questions and decisions are usually pushed up to the next level, making the church ever so much more like a large business corporation than it once was. Certainly, correlation has eliminated overlap and brought a rough order to the chaos accompanying church growth. But it is now almost impossible to conceive of a historian who, like B.H. Roberts, would directly challenge church authority as he did when he published the King Follett Discourse in direct opposite after he had been told directly that he must not do it. A certain amount of the autonomy the bureaucracy lacks is now being exercised by such independent LDS groups as Dialogue and the Sunstone Foundation, who operate outside correlation. and I am quite sure, for the health of the well-being of the tradition. But correlation still hangs heavy over the LDS experience. So there are two sides. Correlation is at once good for Mormonism and bad for Mormonism. It brings order, it helps to preserve identity, but it bears heavily on the saints by concretizing the authoritarian nature of the church through the exercise of authority in a direct and unambiguous line. The question that remains is whether enough healthy tension can be maintained to keep chaos at bay and LDS identity intact in the wide array of cultural situations in which Mormonism finds itself, while the rigidity that would inevitably accompany a perfectly correlated Mormonism is also kept at bay sufficiently to make being a Mormon fulfilling in the world of the flesh and the world of the spirit. The answer to this question of healthy tension may well determine the future of Mormonism as a world religion.
I have some concerns about the remarks that I'm going to make, partly because of the complexity of the topic itself, partly because the paper was late in arriving and I've only had it for a couple of days, and I haven't had time to really organize my own feelings and response to the paper. Also, my remarks are probably confusing because I'm a sociologist responding to a historian in a theological symposium, which doesn't help. First thing that strikes me again, as has been stressed in the paper, is the tremendous complexity of the notion of correlation. That as you look through the way in which it's used and what it does, it can either talk about a form of structuring the educational offerings of the church or the ideology of the church, whichever you prefer. It's a way of, as Ms. Shipps has just indicated, a way of formulating an identity. It has come to be an important mechanism for understanding and structuring the organization of the church. An interesting example of this comes out of a study that was done by Correlation, in which they finally examined what bishops were actually being asked to do by the church. Interestingly enough, none of the general authorities knew what bishops were being asked to do, and the discovery was that the bishop had an impossible organizational task, that he was only being asked to put in about 70 hours a week, not counting his counseling and informal kinds of efforts. But Correlation has performed and has gotten involved in an important organizational evaluation and restructuring of the church. And then the use of the notion of correlation at local levels, where many Mormons have the opportunity of correlating in special meetings that we hide their significance by calling them PECs and BYCs and Correlation Council. I don't understand why that one didn't get a three-letter acronym. But correlation does extend in this very, very complicated set of directions, and because of that, it makes the topic that's treated here very, very difficult to treat in a coherent way in the brief time that Ms. Shipps has had. The idea of correlation being a way of presenting and protecting identity, an appealing kind of notion and an exciting notion. Although I think that it's, and I suspect she feels too, much more complex than is presented in this particular paper. The notion is, I think, that what has happened is that we're not finally getting a Mormon identity, but what we have going on is a shifting identity. That there was an identity present, in response to a set of challenges, there was a perceived need, at least. And I think there's some question as to whether the need was real. But on the part of the upper hierarchy of the church, there was the perceived need that there needed to be a kind of coherent and consistent, clearly articulated and simple statement of the Mormon identity. And the result of that feeling, I suspect, is the publication of some of the books that are now available that have some interesting characteristics and also represent this interesting shift. The books that I grew up on as manuals in the church were books that were signed by T. Edgar Lyon, O.C. Tanner, and we knew who wrote them, and we knew where they stood. An interesting feature of this effort to create and produce and present an identity is that the books are no longer signed for the most part. The manuals are created and copyrighted, but you don't know who wrote them. And as a matter of fact, I think the assumption is that it's unimportant who wrote them because they represent this particular kind of identity that was to be simplified and made coherent. Just as an aside, in my own discipline, I think it's important to suggest that that coherence model of identity is a model that has lost much of its appeal. That in my generation and subsequent generations, there is the genuine sense that identities work very well, even though they may be inconsistent and not very well articulated. And it may be that, as a matter of fact, the effort to structure as rigidly as has been done the Mormon identity may be misguided. I think there's some alternatives to explaining why it is that correlation has become as important and powerful as it has become. It's not only that it did provide identity, but correlation does many, many things for many different leaders of the church. And that is one of the appeals of correlation. It is a way of exercising control. It's a way of making certain that people believe certain things and recognize them as being authoritative. It's a way of eliminating certain kinds of controversy and making certain that the church doesn't appear to be embroiled in controversy. One of the features, I think, of the development of this new identity is that it has become a superficial sort of identity, that it doesn't represent the richness that Ms. Shipps has presented to us today in terms of some of the earlier history. Let me just quickly make two other suggestions. The metaphor was used that in the past the church operated as a series of sticks where each auxiliary functioned with its own particular line and its own autonomy. And this is well represented, for example, in the Relief Society, which used to have its own budget and was a major embarrassment to the priesthood because of its effectiveness and nicely structured organization. Those sticks, I think, have been replaced, and in searching for an alternative metaphor, it seems to me that maybe a funnel and a hierarchy of funnels is what we now deal with. And where the sticks were inefficient in certain ways, funnels are also inefficient in some important ways. Those people who have been involved in the recent changes in the Young Women's Program will have a sense of what that means, where the program finally arrives at a young women's president at the ward level after fighting its way through area presidencies and their presentations and the reinterpretations that regional representatives place on programs, and then their delays, and then it being filtered to the regional level and then to the stake level, and finally to the bishop, who in a 15-minute meeting presents the entire rationale for the new program. And so I think that the result of shifting from sticks to funnels isn't totally what it was hoped to be, that it does have its own, it does create its own kind of confusion and does create its own kinds of delays that are probably just as serious as the sticks were in their era. One last comment. One of the growing roles of correlation is now a role that it plays as part of the church bureaucracy, and I think it's an interesting role, and it's best illustrated by a sort of fourth entity that's been created in correlation. Ms. Shipps mentioned the subcommittees that work with children and their curriculum, the adolescents and the adults. But there's a fourth dimension that's the Evaluation and Correlation Committee, which is involved in generating data to evaluate various kinds of church programs. Now, you want to talk about impressive growth of a bureaucracy. That part of correlation once occupied about a two-office suite on, I think it was the 12th floor of the church office building. It has now reached the point where it occupies virtually the entire floor, has a staff of PhD social scientists that rivals most major universities in size and also in sources of degrees. They're deeply involved in doing research to evaluate church programs. Now, when this started out, they didn't have their own budget. The research was fragmented and very limited personnel. Today, they have their own budget. They establish a list of research programs and priorities. General authorities pass on that. The research is done, and that has become a mechanism for, I think, allowing the lower-level bureaucrats to push up through the bureaucracy suggestions concerning changes. And what it has allowed to happen, and I know some very specific instances of this, is a system which now allows the bureaucrat to subvert the system and make changes in it, so that as they perceive needs for changes in missionary programs or young women's programs, they don't have to rely on the line process, but they can get the research done, present the research in a particular way, and change the opinions of general authorities. And this has happened very dramatically recently with changes in missionary programs. Well, I find this whole topic very, very challenging and exciting. I find Jan's treatment of it challenging and exciting, and I look forward to seeing the next draft of this work.
I think we have time for just a couple questions. Please indicate if you have a question, if it's for Dr. Shipps or for Dr. England. Dr. Paul?
My question is for Dr. Shipps.
And could you come to the mic?
A dimension of correlation has evolved beyond the quest for order and efficiency is uniformity of thought. Does your research show that as
from the beginning, or was there a policy change from along the line, or did it just happen?
The question
has to do with correlation leading toward or creating a uniformity of thought, and has my research found that a change in the correlation system. Actually, I think that it's hard to document that sort of change. I think the basic decision that was made that led in many ways to a lot of the correlation activities as they have developed in recent years is the decision that Mormonism will be the same wherever you go. And if you're going to have Mormonism, you remember the Doug Alder's presidential address to the Mormon History Association was published in the Journal of Mormon History when he talked about different kinds of wards, and yet Mormonism was to be the same in every ward, and that and the whole business of the having all the services on Sunday. What do you call that? I've lost my. Yeah, the block system. That came into existence, according to my research, to make it to keep people in South America from having to walk 20 miles twice a day or twice a week or something like that, and yet they have the same system right here in Salt Lake when you could walk to the ward in 2 minutes or 4 minutes or whatever. Now, that the if you're going to think about Mormonism being a kind of uniform wherever it is, then that means you really have got to develop a kind of controlled thought about what it means to be a Mormon. Does that answer your... We might start a dialogue. Respond, Dick. I mean, you lived it. I didn't. I'm just researching it. Yeah, I think that's probably a good reading of the situation.
Yes, Helen?
What happens when there's in a society when there's just conformity and no chance for diversity of opinion? Well, us Protestants can tell you all about that. It's schism.
I agree. We have almost no models of that sort of thing ever occurring. And one of the reasons is simply that people will find things, do seem to find things on which to disagree.
Actually, within Mormonism, I haven't seen in this mid-20th century Mormonism, I haven't seen any indications of schism so much as I've seen the development of extra ecclesiastical groups, activities, and so forth. So that where everybody used to participate inside the official activities of the church, they tend to participate out. Look at all the people here, for example. That's one of the ways that happens. And another way is people just don't do what they're told, like the bishops.
And the gospel doctrine teachers.
Yeah, that's a good example, too.
We have another question in the back.
I would think you'd have to divide between the experiential and the essentially canonizing doctrine and so forth. I see, I live from the outside and I look at it in books and talking to people and not living it every day, and every week and every year and so forth. But I see a tendency to canonize more and more and more and more of the past. That is to get the story straight and then not to really tolerate, especially in something like the ensign, anything that causes any concern about whether things happened exactly the way the story the church puts out says. But in the experiential part of Mormonism, I think that lots of things work without putting them through correlation. And if they survive, then they get through correlation.
I think I would just say it a little differently. It seems to me that there's almost no room for theological innovation. But when you talk about organizational innovation, as a matter of fact, the Evaluation and Correlation Committee of the Church, working with the bureaucratic departments,
comes to be a new way of implementing and instituting innovation. And if a person who is working at a ward level, for example, is interested in making innovation, place to push it is through that that direction rather than trying to go top down.
I think our time is spent. Thank you very much for this today.